Okay, well, welcome everybody.
You can have your attention, please. A. The one piece of information that you're going to have coming through the door. A.
That's actually
A. Welcome to the AECT Network. It's once more my pleasure to introduce our closing keynote. This is the first time in the history of AECT, we think, that we've had... Well, it's hard to tell. I mean, the last time we had
that. Oh, okay.
Now I can appreciate what you went up to. This is the first time in the history of the AECT, we believe, that the convention has been, for lack of a better term, bookended by the same keynote.
The television term.
The interesting thing for us when we invited Stephen to attend was that one of his conditions for attending was that he gets to stay for the whole thing, which gave us the opportunity to have this bookend happen. And the fact that Stephen is not really one of us, but a philosopher, more than anything, gave us an opportunity to have eyes that are familiar with the field, but not of the field, observe what we do and to comment back to us. So, thank you very much. I introduced you before. He's Stephen Downs. Thank
you. Coming back. this is a very different talk from the other one, which may be a good thing, maybe a bad thing. We'll see. First of all, I need a volunteer. And you will be committed for the entire session. Wonderful. You are our videographer.
Oh, that's not a skill I've got.
You don't need any skill.
You need to be able to push the button.
That's part of the whole point. This is really simple.
I'm the one who has the fingers.
That's fine. There's the audience. There's the fingers. I'm actually going to be using this for an online presentation because I'm going to the University of South Queensland. So, five USP people. USP people. All you have to do is point there at whoever's talking. And you don't have to go right up like that.
We don't want it not to.
If you want it to come, you can see it's got nine times the size of the Bible. But we couldn't do it all still there. So, and that's it.
Okay.
That's good. So use the your tripod, you want to stabilize it or whatever, and you can get your name afterwards and you get proper credit for this.
That's not
fair. I'm trying to capture the back channel too, and the talk and the people. So I want to do a few things, and there might be enough people here to do the thing I want to do at the end, and that will be involving everyone. Now I've got my recorder recording. Right. It's kind of interesting. I am a bit of an outsider, a bit of a philosopher, and sort of all of that sort of thing. I did kind of misjudge this crowd when I came to the conference, which is okay. It happens sometimes. And so I didn't know exactly what I was talking to, but I have a much better idea now, which is I tend to be much better closing statement than an opening speaker. Nonetheless, I had problems with that before. I pressed the thing and it wouldn't go forward. There we go. My opening note, let's see if internet works. That's probably because I don't have a wireless. Sorry about that. How is that getting in?
Oh, then the bottom one. The bottom.
bottom to open your next one.
This should be working.
Record network, access question.
So here we go.
Comments and your opinions as well. So be ready for that. What I'm trying to do right now is frame it with some background thoughts. And background thoughts are the sorts of things that occurred to me as I was wandering around the conference, attending sessions, looking at posters, things like that. So we have two things on the go here. One is the traditional class, and you know about the traditional class. It looks a lot like this, except with fewer video cameras, where you have somebody at the front, and you have all the people who are in the class. And that's the sort of thing that we've captured and replicated and put into our online environments as well, isn't it? It's the sort of thing that we've created with our learning management system. The other thing that really characterized this conference, and I saw it coming up time and time again, is the academic paper. Oh, I don't have it with me. Oh, well, I'll have to make do. But again, we saw presentations that resembled the typical academic paper, where you have the background, the literature review, you have the survey of the students in the class filling out their forms, or the achievement being measured, the typical structure of an academic paper. And it struck me as I was in this conference that both of those things are changing, and they're both changing in the same sort of way, although they haven't hit here yet. So, how are they changing? Well, that worked really well. Here's what learning looks like these days. I don't know how the sound's going to come out, if at all. But it probably doesn't matter a whole lot. You probably can't hear that. Tony works at the Open University in Britain, and we've had conversations back and forth. What he's been doing recently is trying to create syndicated learning materials. And what we've got here is something that he's just came out with today or yesterday called Open Learn Daily. And this is really neat. The idea here is, The idea here is that you can select any one of these learning materials and it'll start sending you learning materials on a regular basis, one day, next day, next day, next day, and it's all supported through RSS and blogging type technology. He's taken that a step further. As I was preparing this morning, he sent me the second link, and sort of the edge, anyhow. This is a social network page that fronts the course delivery page. So now, in addition to just receiving this content through your RSS reader or whatever, now you can exchange the content, send content to your friends, talk about the content, all of that sort of thing. So the idea here is that the learning material shoots out of a place like Open University and into this social network. Now this certainly is not the sort of picture of e-learning that we had when we were talking about learning objects, the learning object standards. It's certainly not the distance education that we all grew up with. It was, of course, we all saw the display. I spent a little time looking at it and thumbing through the journals and all the books and the journals and all of that. Just by the main ballroom area there. And, you know, it's pretty impressive stuff, but I looked at that and I contrasted that in my own mind to what might be called the other academic press. And this is the other academic press. This is, if you will, my academic press. And what we've got here are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people who are working and writing in our field. I just picked one at random, so well, this person hasn't written since August. Most of them write a little more frequently. They're all this is the size of the screen to the block. Anyhow. And the point I'm trying to draw out here is that this stuff comes at me every day. Now, I subscribe to a lot of these feeds. Maybe too many of these feeds. And you might ask, well, how do you even manage something like that? And the way I manage is I use an RSS reader. And taking my RSS reader, which for some reason thinks I'm not logged in at the moment. It's important to log in. This internet connection is working really well. I'm very pleased with that. And so this is something called Google Reader. I subscribe to all those blogs that I showed you on the previous screen. I subscribe to them in Google Reader. And what Google Reader does, here's the list of all these blogs. And I can just go through. This is Nancy White. Nancy White's really interesting. She's more into knowledge management than into e-learning, which is always very interesting to me. The topics will range from e-learning proper to the fires to Twitter, Twitter being banned in Australia, to everything. And this is how I learn. This is how I keep up on our table. The journals over there, nice, useful, 3 years out of date. Nothing personal if you edit a journal, but there's been a lot of talk, especially in the last 12 months, about something called the personal learning environment. And this came up in some of the work that I saw, some of the presentations people were talking about RSS. There was one presentation I saw that talked about using RSS and aggregation in the way I just showed to support the microcredit, I don't want to say discipline or field or enterprise, but to support the microcredit community. And the idea here is to use these tools to help educate lenders and to help educate prospective borrowers of microcredit. And the thing is, it could be any community. And the way the personal learning environment works is you don't go to the school, the college, the university. Rather, you log on to your own system, whatever it may be, and it connects to all of these other places. It connects to blog posts. It connects to to-do lists. It connects to Flickr photographs or YouTube videos or whatever. And this is all connected by means of standards or specifications like RSS. So I've been playing around with this. And this is something I call MyGlue. The microcredit people, they showed a site called SuperGlue. I think it's called SuperGlue. Yeah, it is. I like SuperGlue, but I wanted my own, so I called it MyGlue. And it's a very simple application. Oops, let me save it on the screen. It's a simple application. Oh, I've lost it. Oh yeah, sure. It worked fine like an hour and a half ago. I love it. Unbelievable. It's quite a there we go. Don't you love it when you try something that works? Come here and do it live and like. And what this is, there's my picture. That came from Flickr. It's a very simple application that just gathers this stuff together and presents it on screen. And the code for this is here. And you can have it. It's just simple scripting. No, okay, I can say it's just simple scripting. But the point is, creating this code is within the grasp of all of your students. They could write one of these things themselves. This is not complicated stuff. It's not simple stuff, but I mean, it's not rocket science. It really isn't. You need twice as many lines of code for a rocket. This is another application I've developed. And again, it works really badly because I'm not really a very good programmer. My programming is like, never mind. And this is called the RSS Writer. And what it does, it selects your content source, and maybe I'll pick a better content source, and the RSS latest. And, you know, so we have some content. Here's the picture. We drag the picture into the editor. We can edit our content as well. It's not the world's greatest editing screen in the world, but it kind of works. And then once you're done, you fill in the form and upload it to Blogger. That's all it does. But what the point is here now is I've got a mechanism for bringing content in. I can bring this content in. I can drag it and drop it into my editing screen. I can work with this content, create new content with this content, and upload it to Blogger, and I can do that in 5 minutes. And again, the code that creates this is simple code, like the code for the MyGlue. So, Now we're going to move from the talking part to the question part. But what I want to bring out now is to question, given what I've shown you here, given the very different way of presenting knowledge and information, to question some of the foundations of this discipline. One of the things that struck me as I came here to this conference, is that on the one hand, there's very much a community, and there did seem to be shared values and shared ideas, and there did seem to be this commonality of discipline, if you will. And but I want to push that a bit and see if that's the case. So the very first question, the very first question is to ask, are there things that are known? Is there something that you would say is solid, foundational, underlies the discipline, you can't get away from that? And so now we're going to need to really bring the videographer into, and this is the point where we shift from me talking to having a conversation. This is not a good place to have a conversation. But this is the point where you guys can all make this work really well, or so let's, is there anyone in this room? Okay, great. Just bring the camera up here. But not too close. Okay, so
We know that without social presence, we lose students.
We know that without social presence, we lose students. Okay. How do we know that?
We know that by pure quantification. We know that when a class is identified as not having social presence, let's say we look on a scale continuum, and the class that doesn't have social presence is going to have fewer, and it's going to have more dropouts than the class that does.
Okay. I'm going to push this a little bit. You're not a philosopher. What if our class is the set of people who read the book Moby Dick? Now, I know I'm playing with the word class a little bit, but now, okay, all they have is the book, Moby Dick, and therefore no social presence. Do they drop out? Okay, got a comment with that?
I think that the text of the book isn't symbolic social presence of the author communicating with that class.
The text of the book is the symbolic social presence the author is communicating with that class, which now raises the philosophical hackles in me, because I ask about, is there anything that is not social presence?
No. And I would question one statement, just having administered a system of online learning, professional development for teachers over the last few years. The teachers who are successful in PDF teacher line courses identify their social presence online with each other in professional community without ever having seen each other. They can be scattered all over the world. And I think that your question is, are there things that we know about distance learning? Have we learned and actually think about distance learning and online learning that we know?
I'm not saying that the social presence means being in the same room with a person. In fact, on the contrary, I'm saying just the opposite. I never ever see my students, mm-hmm. but I make a profile. I never see my students. Mm-hmm. I can run into them all, not more than two. But we establish social presence by through interaction, through continuous, right. frequent interaction. So reading the movie Dick might be an educational experience, but it's outside the realm of the instructor's purpose. The instructor has nothing to do with whether or not a student reads or doesn't read or resist. The instruction is something else. The instruction is what takes the student beyond the reading experience and into the instructional experience of elaborating on Moby Dick, of the experience of interacting and learning what others' perspectives are about, what others' interpretations are of what they have said. And so the social interaction is what facilitates learning above and beyond the individual experience of reading.
I think, too, the way, and I'm not an expert, but the way I understood Lauren's initial point was that there's a direct relationship between perceived social interaction and the student's tendency to persist in the instruction. So even in your Moby Dick example, though we may not be able to measure that interaction with that environment, the research that we have available to us would suggest that if we could, those students who would feel a greater level of social interaction would persist in that, albeit solitary, activity than those who didn't. That would be hard to test with most kids.
Well, at the risk of being pedantic, we don't really know that. We have evidence of it, but we don't really know for sure anything about, I think, about distance education, for that matter. Do we know anything about the world?
Well, just to, let's set a standard then.
Checked. If I drop this, do we or do we not know, in a common colloquial sense of the word know, that it will fall?
There's
no longer a magnet or a metal or... Oh, I do have that paper. No.
Did you know that that was in there?
No, actually, and it's not what I thought it was. There, because the amplifier I carried through with the demonstration. You never know. This might be the one in one zillion time it didn't fall. Is there anything in our field as certain as that? Your turn.
Oh, I was just thinking of the establishment of the social context and the interaction is actually creating a common cultural practice. And so by reading Moby Dick, you actually give a commonality to that group or to that class. And those things are structured by the instructor in an online environment by making sure that the interaction provides those that are participating perception of a common goal, a common practice.
Okay, I'm going to go there, but I'm just going to raise the question. Is the accumulation of these statements something like the statement, learning is necessarily social?
In terms of your demonstration, I think of one of Gregory Bateson's favorites, which is, if I strike a bowling ball and have enough data, I can predict absolutely what's going to happen, where it will wind up, or excuse me, a billiard ball.
Sure.
Bowling ball, too. If I hit a poodle, I have no idea what the response is going to be.
Right. So there can be a science of billiards, but can there be a science of, I don't want to say striking the poodle, that's can there be a science of poodles?
Well, there are generalizations. I mean, it's a different kind of I mean, it's not that sort of absolute certainty that you have with Euclidean physics, but the, you know, social science has been able to make generalizations about how people, or I mean, biologists might be able to make generalizations about how living things behave in certain things. They're necessarily different than billiard balls because of different types of things. But there are not certain generalizations. So.
Well, if there are generalities, how much of them inform our discipline? Is our discipline I'm using that word very deliberately. I found myself using that when I was writing these things, these slides. I mean distance education, online learning, something like that. I'm not even sure what the name of it would be. Educational communications and technology. Is it an art or is it a science?
Yes.
Okay. The classic response. Explain.
Well, there are principles that, I would argue that there are principles that can be applied, but the application of those principles, which are derived from generalities, is an art. People apply them in different ways. There are no, if you ask someone to design an interface, you give the, or two people to design an interface, you give them the exact same principles, they will not design the same interface. You ask two teachers to teach the same lesson using the same content and the very same principles of pedagogy, they probably will teach very different lessons. I think the comment that showed up on the board a little while ago, which is when people are involved, it's pretty hard to pick anything, the poop-kicking 101 comment, I think has to do with the artistic properties, the idiosyncratic individualities that people have that make them behave in very different ways. I don't know that that makes it so that we don't know something. It just changes how we interpret it. It's, to some extent, why it's both an art and a science, I would argue.
And I would go with no. Because my answer would be, this is particular how you work with mine, being an artist, you're presuming that there are a whole lot of quasi-scientific rules associated with art, and there are. The distinction is that science and mathematics, particularly Newtonian, is absolutely predictable. That's what defines it. If I perform this experiment over and over and over using the same basic things, it will always come out the same. The magic is the briefcase always falls.
I think the science of whatever, of education, can give us probabilities as well as the evidence. The art is in interpreting those probabilities into what actually is going to happen or may happen.
I just say there's a lot more science to art than most non-artists actually think about. Non-artists didn't think of it as this, you know, totally spontaneous finger painting. No, it's not. It's years of practice, a lot of rules, and a whole bunch of art history.
Nonetheless, if you have a discipline where you give two people the same principles, they go out and they teach in two completely different ways, and presumably you get two completely different outcomes, that seems a lot more like art than science.
So I think that's part of the point of the principles, that you would not expect completely different outcomes. There is such a thing as good instruction. There's good design of instruction, and there is such a thing as bad instruction, and there's bad design of instruction, and you would expect to see different outcomes. You can have different kinds of goodness. But what you would expect is that if the two different teachers were following good principles of instruction design, with good content and knew what they were doing, they could have two completely different lessons that would still get you similar good outcomes.
Or maybe very different good outcomes.
Or different good outcomes. Fair
enough. Well, I think depending on the domain and what we're teaching, we can predict fairly well. I do research in diagnostic problem solving, and I could say that if you engage students with a problem in a certain way, like creating a interrelationship with the underlying knowledge, and if you have them engaged in that way versus some other way, that in general those students will perform better on certain measures that I use. And so that's, in that small example, I think in our field we have tons of those kinds of examples where you can say when students are learning this, if they engage with the material this way, they're going to be more likely to remember it, apply it, whatever, and measure it if they engage with it some other way. But it's not possible to predict
for an individual student exactly how they will respond, or for an individual teacher?
Two things strike me with that. The next thing about being up here, like, it's just the cue. And first of all, the question is how well established those indicators are. I mean, we all know what the indication of falling is, right? We know when this is successfully fallen because it hits the floor. Do we have as clear an understanding of what successful learning is? Because you may recall, in my opening talk, I talked about things like learning is not remembering. I think there is an argument to be made for that. And if learning is not remembering, then demonstrating that somebody can simply remember is distinct from demonstrating that they can learn. And the second point, and it strikes me to be particularly relevant, especially in our field, is that probabilities aren't good enough. The probability of a certain number of people in the class will learn isn't good enough because we're dealing with individuals and everyone needs to learn. And I see a shaking of the head.
No, I
agree. You disagree with that. It's okay to use the phrase leave some of them behind.
Well, at the risk of becoming a social outcast here, I actually would. I would leave 5% behind. I think maybe 2 or 3%, but I would go for the 97% rather than go for the 100. But that's a different issue. What I was really shaking my head about was the probabilities. I think probabilities really are all we have. And I don't see how you can get beyond that. I mean, life is probabilities, and it's about making decisions based on your sense of what the probabilities are. And I don't other than the Newtonian kind of things, which are very well established. Like, yeah, I predict if I let go of something, it will fall. I'm pretty confident about that. But I still, at the most fundamental level, that's still a probability. And I'm considering it to be a very high probability, and I will act as though it is a certainty. But I think fundamentally all we've got in life is probability.
I want to agree and say that, as an example, I think that your second point is akin to saying seatbelts do not, with 100% certainty, prevent death in automobile accidents, and therefore there's no use in using it. So we have principles that we can predict will produce learning as compared to other ones, so we use them and do the best we can with them, though they do not produce certainty. And we don't need to leave learners behind, but using what we know is still beneficial and actually helps us to not leave them behind.
Yeah, and of course, social scientists, this is where we have to act knowing that the probability of something is a moving target, that what we know today in a replicable study 10 years from now, the probability might be lower or even higher. But we work with what we know, and it's important that research be conducted to tell us what probabilities are so that we can design based on the evidence, and so that we can practice based on the evidence of what is effective for the most people.
Okay. Based on those remarks, then, there should not, and try looking this up on Google, a canon of literature. Is there a set of basic foundational literature that defines this discipline in your view?
Yeah. I mean, when I would go back to our history, yes, there is a canon. There is a group. Two things. There's a bunch of things that have been tried and had outcomes. More interestingly, there's a bunch of problems left that we ought to know about and be struggling with.
For example?
Well, in part, all of this discussion here would fall into one way or another one of those two categories. What do we already know? What is our research choice and that sort of thing?
But the other one is, in my mind, what does our research help us do? All right, so we know this. Now what? The next problem is how do we get some pragmatic, real-world value out of what we know?
But it's an implied that commonly agreed upon bit of literature that we would all go back to and universally say, in almost a religious sense, that this is correct. And I'm not sure that we would all buy into the same religion or the same set of pieces. Now, we might be able to negotiate and say, well, if you can have that piece, if I can have this piece. But to say that we would all agree that all of us, just in this room, would agree that a single piece should be in there, I think it would be a really hard place for most of us to get to, because we are more effective.
Well, I think we shared all of our syllabi for our foundation school, so we would all say that.
I don't think so. Five faculty members at my position, five visions of foundation overlap, included about five reasons.
Because the canon is, you know, really entrenched in the dialogue and whatnot. And it's not so much that everybody would use the exact same literature for the exact same purposes, or even have the exact same interpretation of that literature. But that there's an agreed-upon body where we say, this represents something meaningful. Now, that something meaningful may be very different for different people. Heart of Darkness is a classic example of something very different. It can be widely interpreted for very different audiences. But nonetheless, it's part of the recognized canon in the body of literature that if you know your proverbial stuff, you know Heart of Darkness, you know really Shakespeare. So I think that's kind of what we're talking about here is if you're going to be able to have an informed dialogue as part of our discipline, you know, there are certain pieces that you've got to know about and you have to be willing to engage on regardless of your interpretation of that. And part of the purpose of it, you know, what purpose is a canon there, well, I think this becomes a fundamental aspect of how you define what constitutes a discipline. Is there some sort of collective body of evidence around which we organize ourselves and have an ongoing discourse? And if we don't have a canon, you know, whatever falls within that, we can get into a huge debate over what goes in the canon and what doesn't. But if you don't have that canon, then it's almost a question of pretending how to discipline if you don't have a canon.
It's not about a common body of knowledge, though. It's about whether or not it's a canon. That's the question. A canon means that we all buy into it as having equal value.
But canons are always, including religious canons, are always in flux and they're always being modified. And in his literary text, I mean, every time a new work enters the literature, it modifies canon and it changes. So, I mean, it's a system that's always in flux, but which you can sort of, and where at any individual point you can find out. I fight you about whether or not Heart of Darkness knows the canon, because but you can sort of step back from that individual point and sort of say, this rough area over here is important, and this area over here is not so important. But I think the boundaries of any canon or any discipline or any body of knowledge are always are never going to be distinct.
And part of that is it's not even about the individual pieces themselves so much, but it's about the sort of larger discourse surrounding them. The bigger discourse there, like in English, would be, well, what constitutes great literature? And does this rise to the occasion of something that constitutes great literature? The same thing with an art and our discipline. Is this good research? Is this informative? Does that rise to the level of something that we think can actually inform most of us in what we do?
Well, it's interesting that to me that you can ask this question because this for me the past year has been the big question I've been asking myself about our field, and at this particular conference I've heard terms used
in ways that historically would have been considered to be inaccurate based on the canon. For instance, the term of justice is being used differently at this conference than I've ever heard it used before, the term bold. These are terms that used to be very clearly defined in the and used consistently, particularly this conference of all conferences. And our canon seems to me to be no longer in place. So this, I think this is a big question for us in the head. People are being trained differently, people are being trained in a different definition of our field. This is very interesting at this conference.
Well, I think to me the interesting thing about canons are that it doesn't have to be inorganic, it can really be organic. And in some ways it's essentially the playground that we work for, that this ongoing discourse about who are we and what are we doing.
This is one for the grad students who may be watching this. In our discipline, what is a good masonry? Does it have to have a literature review, for example? And if it has to have a literature review, does it have to refer to certain specific authors? Can you get away with talking about evaluation without talking about Kirkpatrick, for example?
The way I would.
We know what Chancellor is doing. Anyone saying yes to that?
I think we do. But I think a good paper is something that introduces great ideas. Now the question is, what do you put around that? In the traditional good paper, the lit review's purpose is to validate that the person was well read. I don't know whether Newton came up with new ideas without having read the literature. But I know that many great thinkers have come up with ideas which they may owe very little to the literature, particularly if the literature was incorrect. Often a great idea gets castigated in the literature for 50 years before anybody gives them any credit for being a really good idea. It just happens that way, the slow boat to turn. But I would think that if it's a really good paper, it does something to the reader, inform the reader in some way that the reader has not been informed otherwise. And I would assume, therefore, that that would be something that would be recognized, even if it didn't have all the trappings of academia.
So you would agree then, let's just say there's a list of trappings that we won't go into detail, but they are neither necessary nor sufficient to establish what a good paper is. Which leads to the question of the form that we use, whether we need it at all. You see, like I again looked at this alternative canon, all these bloggers and that, and I'll tell you right off the bat, there are no lit, well, I won't say no, there's not very many lit reviews in any of those blog posts. They don't do that. But they do link back to each other. And the purpose of the linking back isn't to establish personal credibility. That, and especially in the case of these informal online writings, it's carried almost entirely by the idea that the purpose is to establish credit or origin of ideas rather than to establish oneself as being in a legitimate part of the canon.
Well, another purpose of the lit review, or whatever the linking is, linking back to previous ideas, is to establish context of the idea. We don't come up with completely brand new ideas anymore, I don't think. There's always something that, some giants that we are standing on the shoulders of. And in order to understand the idea, we have to have the context of it. That's what the lit review or the links to the other things. I agree that it doesn't have to be a lit review. It can be something. But it has to have the purpose that the lit review has.
Do you think that establishing the context is related formally or perhaps semantically to social presence? Thought just occurred. I thought I'd make an error.
It establishes credibility. I mean, we're getting back into the classical rhetoric, right? That you establish ethos, your personal credibility, the speaking on the subject, you establish pathos connection to the audience. And the lit review does both. It says, I've read all this stuff, I know what I'm talking about. It also says, you and I have read the same stuff, so we speak the same language. When I say objective, I'm using it in this sense that you also accept. And then the logos, which is the argument in itself, its own internal logic. You could say, I mean, going back to classical rhetoric, you could say that there are some things like the cool paper, which is that it uses all three of those in a certain kind of balance, that it doesn't abuse any of those aspects by engaging in fallacies. That's really high level in general, and it doesn't really help freshmen. And say, okay, well, you've got to use all three aspects of the proposal triangle to make a good paper. They want to know, you know, how many paragraphs, how long, do I have to copy something for the first? You know, they want these strict formal things, which we know you can give them, you know, you can give them that laundry list of trappings that are usually in good papers, and it still doesn't guarantee that they write a good paper. It's something more ineffable than that.
Same question, except applied to the resources instead of the paper. The learning, I said learning resource very deliberately instead of course, because of course, the beginning of this, I showed you some learning resources that didn't really resemble what we would call good distance learning resources in the traditional sense, like the YouTube video. RSS in plain English, which seems to violate a lot of the rules. So, what is a good resource? What is a good learning resource? Does it have to have learning objectives? Does it have to have been developed using ADDIE or some similar methodologies? Does it have to include an evaluation component or social presence component? Does there have to be discussion or some sort of interaction in a learning resource? Any of these things absolutely necessary?
I'm inclined to say yes on social presence, for sure. In much the same way we discussed the literature review, and we kind of all need to be on the same page to use that phrase to start, and from there then we can begin exploring topics. One of the things that I believe is so important in the research is when I'm teaching the topics is
it's just your comments made me think of my opening talk where I was not in sync with this audience and I certainly felt that. So that to me lends an air of validity to what you just said. Any other comments on this?
I tend to think in terms of old-fashioned outcomes, so I would define a good learning resource as one that results in learning. And so, do all of the things that we discussed happen present? I mean, you have some good learning resources on your slide there. One's a basketball. Is a basketball an essential learning resource for learning to play basketball? Yes. It's not an essential learning resource for learning to play golf or philosophy. And so, I think that if you look at it that way, then whatever produces good learning is a good learning resource. But again, going back to sort of heuristics or general ideas, there are some things that we found through practice, which we call instructional design, that tends to help to guide that process of producing resources that tend to lead to learning.
Sorry, I don't mean to interrupt, but I just need to know this.
Does everybody agree on what learning is? because I've been trying to sort of, I saw that comment earlier, trying to pull this together, but I'm not going to pull it all together. Sorry. But I mean, still coming at this again from different angles. Again, I mean, well, here's how many of you think that learning is remembering?
Well, maybe part of it.
I was going to say, I was first struck with the no in italics. Maybe it was your original slide.
Right.
Philosophically, Stanley Cavell devotes about, I don't know, 15, 20 pages to the word no, which makes my head hurt. But it's a fascinating, fascinating read. And you're doing the same thing here.
Just
learning remembering. Absolutely. Just as no in the biblical sense means something that you don't normally think about. Yes, it is. It's not the only or the exact definition of learning by any sense. Could we all agree on everything that constitutes learning?
Other comments?
Comment. I think in terms of your question of what is learning, my guess would be, though, that if in a group, if within our organization, for example, because of the shared experiences we have and because of the shared background we have, I do not think we would get 100% agreement there. I just don't get that. But I would suspect we could come as a group to a very strong consensus about what learning is, and we would be able to come up with a definition that most people would agree with and be happy with it. But I think there's that level of continuity that we can get to. So, you know, do we know what learning is? Is it something that we can all rattle off the answer right away in an elevator and would agree with everyone else's? Probably not, but I would guess that it would be close, and then if we work together, we would certainly come to the consensus. I may be wrong about that.
I would suggest that it would probably be a good thing to do. People have a consensus about what gravity is, mass is, and even you talk about sociology, the example that always springs to my mind in sociology and probability is road design. I love road design, but I'm in my element here. And they design those left turn lanes,
right?
And they have to design them to be a certain length long. And they do that according to the probability that somebody will turn left. But everyone knows what turning left is. But it's not clear that everyone knows what learning is.
But, okay, so let me react to that, because I think you're confusing a couple different things here. Because you're talking about a definition of learning, right? Can we define it? Can we say what it is?
Right.
And that's what I'm saying, is we wouldn't all necessarily use the same words, and we wouldn't get 100% coverage of it. It doesn't mean we don't all know what learning is, right? Because you're talking about gravity and mass, all right? If we were to say what gravity is, we wouldn't all use the same word, right? We wouldn't all come up with that same definition. We wouldn't express it in the same way. Does that mean we don't know what gravity is? No, it doesn't. I don't think you can conclude from that we don't know what this something is. And I think the same thing is true with learning. The fact that we wouldn't all agree on, or we wouldn't all say the same thing when we started to define learning, does not mean that we don't collectively know what learning is, or you know what learning is.
I see learning in the same sense as the word truth. Do we all agree what truth is? I really don't think so. We don't agree what learning is for some of the same reasons that we see the world differently.
First off, we know what gravity does. Predictably. We have no idea what it is. We just something to really keep in mind. The other is, in this discussion, I'm always reminded of A.E. Housman's comment about what a poem is. And he said, I don't know, but I do know that it makes the hair on the back of my neck stand up. And I think that we could really think about that in terms of learning.
I don't know what it is, but I recognize it when I see it.
Yeah. I was going to say that because I think that's a good point, but I think that as our ability to measure gravity
in different ways increases our understanding of the way we find it. It's the same as pure learning. We used to find learning behavioral. That's still very useful to us, and a lot of us do it, because as we watch behaviors change, we can think that there's some change in learning. But we all agree that that's not all there is. But we don't know physiologically what's going on biologically, what's going on in other ways. We can't measure it perfectly yet. Our ability to find it is constantly changing.